This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwestern studios in La Crosse, and I'm glad you've joined us today. We've got a couple of interesting COVID-19 related stories to talk about. Coming up on the program, we're going to hear from child care providers and see how people in that industry are faring as the COVID-19 crisis continues. And then in the second half of our program today, we're turning the page from COVID-19 and focusing on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, which is coming up next week as well. But first, we're joined with new news this week by Jen Rombalski, the health director for the La Crosse County Health Department. Jen, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Great. How are you today?
Fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us again and for the work that you've been doing, you and your staff, on this issue over the last several weeks, especially intensely. Now, we have a pretty new announcement Thursday. The governor announced an extension of the Safer at Home order. So what does that mean for residents of La Crosse County?
Yeah, so this is an announcement that came out on Thursday, as you indicated, and the governor is indicating that the Safer at Home order will extend until May 26th. So some points of importance to share about this extension. It does indicate that schools will be closed. Businesses are allowed to do some baseline functions, including delivery and curbside pickup. There are some limitations that are being added to, like our large big box stores. Golf will be allowed, so for those outdoor enthusiasts, and I know I've spoken with a couple of golf course operators, golf courses will be able to open, except there won't be any allowance of golf carts. Social distancing will need to be maintained, only household members, and making payments by phone or online because clubhouses and shops won't be open. Continuing to have strong discouragement of any travel unless it's for essential purposes, just as we have now. Also indicating salons and spas must remain closed, libraries closed for in-person service, and arts and crafts stores may offer curbside pickup of fabric mask supplies. So those are kind of the overall highlights of the order.
In terms of La Crosse County, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture of it because I know I understand the need for caution that you've been highlighting over the last several weeks. But because of everyone's adherence to the Safer at Home guidelines, La Crosse County has so far not experienced any deaths from COVID-19, has experienced relatively few hospitalizations. And most of the people who have experienced COVID-19 are on the road to healing. So talk a little bit about what the current situation is health-wise in La Crosse.
Yeah, we are doing really well here in our county. I look at surrounding counties, and I have seen a number of counties around us that have had increased case numbers. So in particular, I think about Winona County in Minnesota, and that isn't far away from us here in La Crosse County. And when we are not under Safer at Home orders, there is a lot of movement across counties in our area. And Winona County has had an interesting situation there that I think could happen anywhere, which is they had an outbreak happening in a facility, a long-term care facility that was essentially they just couldn't figure out where the source was coming from. So they did some testing and found out that there were individuals that did not have symptoms that were testing positive and were likely shedding virus and spreading the virus in the facility. So I think that's the kind of sort of unknown we have in our community and other communities about coronavirus, this novel strain, is its ability to spread amongst individuals that don't have symptoms. So that is really concerning because, again, we are not testing as broadly as we need to be in the future. I foresee that the testing will be ramping up in the next number of weeks. That will definitely be something we're all working towards to make sure we have enough supplies and capacity to do the testing. And I think that when that happens, we'll be able to get a better understanding of what's really happening in the community, because right now the case numbers only tell the story of those that qualify for testing and get tested and are positive. They don't tell the story of those that don't qualify for testing because the testing supplies and capacity have not been at the level where we need them to be.
When somebody gets tested, they test positive. They're maybe not in the hospital, but they're under very strict orders about their own movement and everything like that. But how far out do the ripples of that go? How many layers of contacts between this person and other people does the health department have to chase down to determine where the disease might have spread to?
In terms of layers, predominantly two layers. So the person who tests positive and then all of their contacts. I think the challenge with that is when you're speaking with someone on the phone who's maybe not feeling the best and they have, you know, we're looking back maybe 7 to 10 days to get to 2 days prior to symptoms beginning. You know, it's tough for folks to think through all the things that they might be doing. So that's a long, sort of really comprehensive conversation. Those actually are the more clear-cut options. So compared to when you don't have a positive test result and you've got somebody who might be showing symptoms that are consistent with COVID-19, but we don't know for sure because they haven't been tested. Then those folks were only saying, you know, we need you to remain in your house until your symptoms, it's been at least 7 days since the start of your symptoms, and they've improved significantly, and you don't need to have, like, fever-reducing medication or cough-suppressant medication. So those are the tougher ones because then we don't really get a handle on all of their contacts because they weren't a lab-confirmed case. We still certainly educate them, but it is a little more difficult to really get a solid handle on all of the contacts.
People are going a little bit stir crazy if my neighborhood is any indication, and I know they're eager to find exceptions to the rule. Like, what exactly can I get away with? What am I exactly allowed to do? What's your word to people who are thinking there are so few cases in La Crosse County and in our region in general? What is the harm really in letting up a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I feel that myself, and I hear that from those that I'm connected to in my own family and my own circles. And I think the most important piece to talk about here is the level of disease that can be spread by those that don't have symptoms. So if you can visualize thinking about, you know, three or four people who are not from the same household sitting together, for example, thinking they're doing okay and the right thing, and one of them actually has the virus and does not have any symptoms and does not know that they're potentially spreading it to others, that is really scary, to be honest. And we just have to balance out what we know about this virus with our human behavior and the fact that we do get a little stir crazy and impatient. It is tough. There's nothing else to say than to acknowledge it is really tough to be told that you cannot be with your friends and family outside of your household. But again, this is for a significant reason. There are people dying in our state and in our country. We have to do the right thing, and we have to do it as long as is necessary in order to assure that this virus doesn't win. You know, we're really in a war with this virus, and we need to win. This virus cannot beat us.
Now, something that your department is helping to promote, along with the Hunger Task Force, is an opportunity for people to help out, which is, I know a lot of people who've been stuck at home have been looking for a way to help contribute to some kind of solution here. Talk about a little bit about the food drive effort that you're engaging in with the Hunger Task Force.
Yeah, this is such a neat effort. So, you know, there are individuals in our community that are, you know, they don't have their jobs anymore. They're really struggling with food security or being food insecure. And this is a partnership that the health department has with the Hunger Task Force. And really, we have this wonderful donor from the community who wants to remain anonymous and has provided $25,000 of match so that if you give food or if you give dollars, then those dollars will be matched up to that dollar amount. So these are going to be on Fridays now from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. starting today on the 17th. And then we'll go through the 24th of April, May 1st, 8th, 15th, 22nd, and 29th. And they will be at three locations. So in the Onalaska area, it'll be at the Valley View Mall parking lot by the former Macy's location. downtown La Crosse. It'll be in the La Crosse County parking lot behind the courthouse and law enforcement center, and on the south side of La Crosse, so in the Big Lots parking lot. So it's just a wonderful opportunity to serve our community. And another plug, too, for if you can get out there and participate in a blood drive, if you can donate blood, that's another area where you can really do a lot of good.
Absolutely. So we'll be talking about those opportunities to serve our community on future programs, I know. Jen Rombalski has been our guest this morning. She's the health director for the La Crosse County Health Department. Jen, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can find contact information on our website. That's WPR.org. Coming up after this quick timeout, we're having a conversation with child care providers and taking the temperature of that industry, which is facing some changes in light of COVID-19. That's all coming up. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in the Southwestern Bureau studios in La Crosse. I'm joined today as we continue our coverage on how our communities are reacting to COVID-19 and the Safer at Home order and all things thusly related. We're talking today with Audra Weiser from The Parenting Place, Early Childcare and Education Director of The Parenting Place, and we're talking to Angie Paff of Kids at Play Childcare Center. First, ladies, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having
thank
me.
You for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm interested in hearing, we'll get into the conversation about, you know, how kids are handling this and how your business is doing through all this. But let me first give each of you an opportunity to tell a little bit about what you do. And Audra, we'll start with you. Talk about The Parenting Place for those who aren't familiar. What is it that you do there at The Parenting Place?
Sure. So The Parenting Place is a combined family resource center and child care resource and referral agency. So my role with The Parenting Place as Early Care and Education Director is to oversee the child care related programs, which connect parents with child care and provide various supports for existing child care sites in a six-county area.
What kind of services or information might people find typically outside of this COVID-19 crisis that we're dealing with now? What people might typically come to your agency for?
Sure. Typically, and even during this crisis, parents can come to us for help in finding child care that matches their needs, the days and hours that they would require care or the ages that they're looking for in the area that would be most convenient to them. We also offer child care certification. So for people that want to become certified to do child care in their homes, we offer pre-licensing consultations for folks that either want to be licensed to do child care in their homes or become a licensed group center. We do Young Star quality ratings and provide technical support to those who are looking to improve quality. And then we provide professional development to child care providers on various topics, from social emotional development to hand washing to anything that has to do with their day-to-day operations, including business practices.
And speaking of child care providers, we have a very experienced one on the line with us as well, Angie Paff of Kids at Play Child Care Center. Angie, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do?
So again, my child care facility is called Kids at Play Child Care Center. We've been open for 18 years. We do provide child care services for children ages 6 weeks through 12 years. And we are licensed by the state of Wisconsin. And then we do participate in the Young Star program through the Parenting Place. So we provide services before and after school, and then also part-time care and full-time care for working parents.
I'm curious to find out about how your businesses, how the child care industry, I hate to call it an industry, but it is an industry in Wisconsin, in southwestern Wisconsin, has been affected by all this. Audra, what have you been hearing from some of the providers that you have contact with about how those businesses have been affected by COVID-19?
Well, as you can imagine, as more parents are home, the enrollment in child care centers has decreased dramatically throughout the weeks during the stay-at-home order. We've seen 37% of child care sites close statewide. In our area, it's about 30% right now. But the sites that are still operating are really struggling with low enrollment. Parents have tended to, because they're home and they're not, many are not working, they've tended to pull their children from childcare as they cannot afford to pay holding fees. And before this crisis, childcare was so hard to find. You know, they're just taking their chances, hoping that childcare will be available when we come out of this. So that was, I think, a surprise to a lot of people. Originally, with the school closure, it was thought that there would be an influx of a lot of children into childcare, but we've really seen the opposite happen. On top of that, we've seen some concerns around the health and safety of the staff that are still working in childcare centers. They're concerned for their own health and safety and the health and safety, of course, of the children that they're watching, which are, you know, still in groups. Childcare centers have a ton of, you know, health and safety practices that are enforced, so they are, you know, doing everything they can to protect the health and safety of the children. But we've also seen food and supply shortages, just as families have seen when they go to the stores and the shelves are empty. So that has created a lot of challenges for the sites as well to be able to serve the children as best they can.
Angie, how has your business been affected? Do you still have children coming to the Kids at Play childcare center?
We do. We are still open. We're licensed for 75 children on an average day. Kind of before the virus outbreak, we would average 60 to 65 kids a day. We are down to about 25 to 30. Per day, and some days are less than that. We do service a lot of essential workers. We have a lot of people that work at the hospitals, some law enforcement, a few grocery store employees. So their children obviously are still coming to care, but a dramatic, you know, increase, at least half are staying home with their parents, or the parents are working from home and then choosing to keep their children home for the Safer at Home Act. So
I'm interested to know how you've had to adjust your practices, either whether it's practices throughout the day or whether it's practices for intake and sending them home at the end of the day, how those things have been adjusted in terms of the cleaning and different things that are happening now.
Yeah, so we already clean quite frequently on a regular basis, lots and lots of cleaning. We've just upped the hand washing even more, upped the children's hand washing even more. You know, anytime we're unsure, we're sending them to the sink to wash, same with staff. We have put hand sanitizer in the front of our center, so everyone is required to gel in and out. I do have a cleaning crew of two people that come in after hours, so they've upped their cleaning, and we're getting the high-touch surfaces more than usual, you know, frequently throughout the day, as well as at the end of the night and then in the morning when we come back in again. As far as our health policies with children, we have decreased some of those to, you know, if they have, it used to be a fever of 101, now we're at 100.4, and we will send them home. If we have children that are coughing or, you know, can't contain the way they cough, or excessive drooling, different things like that, we have been sending children home for that, just because we're trying to limit the spread and kind of stay here as long as we can to provide care for the parents that need it.
Audra, when the state issued its Safer at Home order, or during the other guidance that might have come out from the different state agencies that oversee the way people do business in the public, did they have specific guidelines for childcare providers about what precautions need to be taken?
They did, as Angie outlined. Several centers have implemented some screening practices, and they've been looking to various resources within the community to help out with those, which has been very helpful. But many are, you know, checking temperatures or asking screening questions as children are being dropped off or picked up.
Children are, we think of them as young and impressionable, but they're often more astute than we give them credit for. And I know they've got to be picking up on what's going on. What do kids know about what's happening in society right now?
You know, I think right now we're just relying on, the teachers and the parents to be honest with children, but communicate that at a developmentally appropriate level. A lot of questions about, you know, if children are at home, why am I not going to school? Or, you know, why am I not seeing as many friends in childcare as I would normally see? And, you know, just communicating as honestly as they can, but, you know, keeping it at a level where, you know, it's not scary. So, you know, you will see them again. This is what we're dealing with right now. And, you know, we'll be doing doing this and keeping you safe and healthy.
Angie, you've got such a wide range of kids at your center. What are you hearing from them about this? What do they talk about?
You know, most of our children are of the younger age, and some of them are still coming kind of on a consistent routine, which was their routine before the whole outbreak of COVID-19. We do have a few school-age children that, you know, they understand that people are getting sick and they're, you know, not in school, so more people don't get sick. So they're just, our school-age kids seem to be adjusting okay. They just know they're coming here to do their homework, and we're helping them with that. And they're kind of going about their daily routines. They do stay, you know, we miss our friends, and we're just reassuring them, you know, everyone's staying healthy and safe, and, you know, we'll be back and be able to see our friends soon again. So as Audra said, kind of age-appropriate things is what we need to tell them, is not to scare them as well.
I know it's hard to look into the future in terms of this, but do you see things that that you wish more people were aware of, or that maybe the public should be aware of what this has all been like for people in your industry?
I feel like childcare is a needed source of industry in the world for parents to be able to work. And maybe we weren't necessarily seen as such essential workers before, but I do hope that now, looking into the future, other industries will look at us and maybe be more appreciative of the work that we do with young children, just so they would understand that they can still go to work and we're here to provide care for their kids. So hopefully we'll be known a little better in the industry work world, I guess.
Yeah, Audra, I'm interested in kind of how you might help. You do training with child care professionals, people who wish to become child care professionals. What's advice that you can offer people who might not have that professional training, but yet might find themselves caring for children amidst an already busy life, trying to get work done, trying to take care of a household, and now they've got kids home from school? What's your advice to them about how to provide structure and routine and whatever else kids might need through something like this?
Right. You know, it's a lot to take on. And I think, like Angie said, more than ever, we are seeing childcare as essential and as that economic necessity that, you know, maybe the attention hasn't been there in the past. I think that we need to be careful about putting too much pressure on parents to feel like they need to take it all on, especially for the younger children. Play is essential, and they really learn through play. So feeling pressure to teach, you know, all the time, or provide real structured lessons when the children are home is not necessarily what we would want to see. Just providing those open play opportunities, being interactive with the children, that teaches language development and all those basic concepts that we want to see, you know, especially those younger preschool children learning, whether they're at home or whether they're in an early childhood environment.
So as time goes on, what resources do you think need to be made available to child care centers in terms of the business side of it, the assistance programs that are coming out, small business loan programs that are being made available through government agencies, different kinds of stimulus packages? Are those, do you know whether A, they're available to child care providers, or B, what kind of programs you might like to see on that side of the equation?
Right. Fortunately, the economic viability of childcare centers is at the forefront, you know, from the state level all the way down to the local level. So I'm encouraged by that. We really need these childcare centers to be there on the other end of this crisis. They are an economic necessity, and we were already in a childcare crisis before this hit. So the supply of childcare was already inadequate to meet the demand. So there are some programs currently available, and there are other proposed supports for childcare, and I'm really encouraged by what I'm hearing. Currently, like you mentioned, there are the SBA loans available, but there are also proposed grants for essential workers to pay for childcare, proposed hazard pay for childcare providers that are still in the field working, a proposed expansion of Wisconsin Shares eligibility for essential workers, and proposed grants for those childcare centers that have closed so that they can continue to maintain staff and reopen when we're on the other end of this. So, like I said, those are just proposed measures, but the fact that they are being talked about and the funding from the federal government is there to support many of these programs is a very encouraging thing at this point.
Angie, what about you? You said you've got about half the kids coming that normally would. How's that affecting the long-term health of business?
Well, it depletes what small amount of extra income you had, if you can call it extra income. We are still charging parents if they are staying home at a decreased rate of what they would normally pay. So that's helped a little bit. I'm down, you know, workers. I have a staff of 19 and I'm down to, you know, 5 to 6 staff a day. So that helps a little bit. But, I mean, obviously it's the economic relief that we're going to need. I personally have applied for SBA loans as well as I'm sure many of the child care providers in the area, and I'm hoping that that relief will come. So when we go back to normal, if there is a normal, you know, I want to hire all my staff back and I want them all to have a job and be able to provide quality care for children.
All right. We're speaking today about COVID-19's effect on the child care industry here in southwestern Wisconsin and how providers are affected, how families are affected, and more. And we've been speaking with Angie Paff of Kids at Play Child Care Center and Audra Weiser of The Parenting Place. And I want to give each of you an opportunity to let us know where we can get a hold of you. Angie, first, where can people reach Kids at Play?
Yep. So our telephone number is 608-788-1847. And our facility is located just south of Goose Island, right off of Highway 35.
Okay, down by Stoddard.
Yep, that is correct, between Stoddard and La Crosse.
Audra, what about The Parenting Place? Where can people find the resources available from The Parenting Place?
Right. The Parenting Place is, we have an office in La Crosse at 1500 Green Bay Street. Unfortunately, you know, we're under the stay-at-home order as well right now, but they can reach us at 608-784-8125 or email us at info@theparentingplace.net, and we will respond to those requests just as soon as we can.
That's Audra Weiser, Early Child Care and Education Director at The Parenting Place. Also Angie Paff of Kids at Play Child Care Center. Thank you very much for joining me, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to see more on our coverage of COVID-19 and the Safer at Home order as the weeks have gone on, you can find that on our website. It's WPR.org/newsmakers. Coming up after the break, we're turning the page and focusing on a different issue. It's Earth Day at 50. We're going to talk about it next here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio's Southwestern Bureau in La Crosse. I'm Ezra Wall. This is Newsmakers. Thank you so much for listening today. This segment, we're shifting, we're turning the page a little bit, focusing on Earth Day for the rest of the show today. It's the 50th anniversary of Earth Day this year, and environmental concerns are so important, I know, to our residents. And so we're bringing that conversation to the fore today. Our two guests this segment are Kathy Van Maren, a board member with the Coulee Region Sierra Club, and Carol Abrahamson, the executive director of the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Absolutely. Now, let's get started just talking about Earth Day itself, sort of as an international phenomenon. 50 years ago, Earth Day was founded, so to speak. 50 years on, let's talk about why Earth Day is still so relevant and so important. Kathy, let's start with you. Why is Earth Day such an important thing to remember?
Well, I think we're still facing a lot of the same issues we were facing at the first Earth Day. We have oil spills, we have pollution, we have all kinds of climate issues, and that's something new. But we have big issues that we need to do something about, we need to educate people about, and we need to motivate people about.
Carol, what's your reflection on Earth Day 50 years on?
You know, quite frankly, I think Earth Day is more important now than it ever has been, and that is because of climate change. And, you know, this year, Earth Day's theme is climate action. So clearly, the biggest challenge that we face beyond the immediate pandemic is climate change. It's something that affects the future of humanity and the life support systems that make our world habitable for us. So this is a big deal and a big day. It's kind of a historic moment, and it's a time for us to unite and be innovative and creative and brave and try to work on this climate change issue that faces us.
You both mentioned climate change as being important. I don't think anybody can deny the importance of that issue and sort of its being in the forefront of the environmental conversation now. Looking back over the last 50 years, has that always been the case, or were there other issues that might have been more prominent in the early days of Earth Day?
Originally, I think that pollution was a major issue. You know, rivers were catching on fire. You couldn't eat fish. Mercury pollution was just starting to be known about. And so I think that was a motivating factor for many people. I was a high school junior, actually, at Central for the first Earth Day. And I don't really remember anything specific about it, but I do remember that we talked a lot about recycling, because we realized that plastic and pollution and just stuff was polluting the earth. So we wanted to do something about it. Now, as it turns out, that maybe wasn't the best thing to do, but that was the best thing we knew to do at the time.
Carol, you were about to say something as well.
Yeah, well, I was actually going to say exactly what Kathy said, and we were more focused on pollution, air and water pollution, and just the cleanup part of it, as I too remember as a child, is you know, the litter bug campaign and cleaning up our air and our water. So it was a different focus in a different time, and I don't know that we at that time knew that what we were doing was going to lead to climate change. It certainly wasn't on the radar of everybody that it is today.
You talked about climate change being a big global concern. Is that what you would classify as maybe the most pressing environmental concern globally?
If we continue on the path that we're on, everything that we have done to better the earth thus far won't matter. And we've got to change that trajectory. We've got to make some drastic changes. And it feels like right now, in one way, the pandemic is helping in the sense that we aren't moving about as much, we aren't creating as much carbon, but I wonder if when we all get back to our so-called normal daily lives, if that will be something that we'll remember and try to continue with, or if we'll just go back to the way it's been.
Or you could even see people sort of, I mean, not with the specific intention of harming the environment, but kind of making up for lost time almost.
Right.
Well, to me, that's why this Earth Day is so important, because this is an opportunity sort of during a pause period to really have people think about how living, how we're moving around, where we live, how we work, what kind of food we eat, all the things that go into carbon emissions, and how can we change? You know, a lot of times if you get sick or something like that, you know, if a catastrophe happens in your life, there's a time period in there when you can say, do I really want to do everything exactly the same going forward, or are there some things that I need to change? And so this is an opportunity for us to maybe kicking off with Earth Day, although some of us have been working on it before that, but to really make people focus on how can we move forward without this massive increase in greenhouse gas emissions, without going back to the old ways of, you know, shipping food all over the world so we can have fresh whatever it is in the middle of winter. So maybe it's a great opportunity to really think about how do we want to move forward.
Speaking of changing behaviors, that's kind of the other side of the coin of what we've just been talking about. If climate change is the big concern, then what behavior is it, or what solution is it that we need to be focused on if we're focusing on climate change as the concern? What's the solution?
Well, Ezra, this is Carol. At Mississippi Valley Conservancy, over the last couple of years, we've had a working group that has looked at climate change and what we as an organization could do. And we've worked with the Nature Conservancy has a model that we've looked at, and the Land Trust Alliance, and the research that's been done showing that 20% of the carbon mitigation could come from something called natural land solutions. And that's just where we are preserving land from development, which is the work that we do at the Conservancy every day. And by preserving grasslands, for instance, that hold the carbon in the soil, you know, once it reaches those deep prairie grass roots and it's stored in the soil, it doesn't come back out unless we plow it up. And therefore, if we can protect that land from ever being developed, you know, plowed, then that carbon will remain stored there. And forests are a great mechanism for taking carbon out of the air. So the work that we do in protecting land is almost a quarter of the solution to what we see as climate change right now.
Yeah, on the other side of it, the Sierra Club has been working on people-type issues that can make a difference. For example, there's the nationwide Ready for 100 movement that's been going on for several years. And right now there are, I don't know how many, more than 150 communities around the country who, and some states, who have committed to getting all their energy from renewable sources and reducing their carbon emissions to zero by a set date. For some people, it's already happened. For City of La Crosse, it's 2050. For other places, it's 2035. So that's one big thing. We need to move from fossil fuel energy to renewable energy. And that also means natural gas. I was just before this, I was reading an article about how cities and communities around the country are saying to, are changing their policies so that new development and redevelopment has to be natural gas free, because that is also a fossil fuel, and we know it's much more awful for the environment than originally people were saying it is. So that's one thing. The Sierra Club is also working on solar on schools, you know, encouraging big solar installations on schools, not just for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but also, you know, providing a model in the community, getting students involved and interested, and providing them with real life experiences in jobs of the future.
We're speaking with Kathy Van Maren, who you just heard from the Coulee Region Sierra Club, and Carol Abrahamson of the Nature, the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. And I'm pleased to have them join us today to talk about Earth Day and what we can all do to preserve and protect our environment around us. We'll continue that conversation on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, our website is wpr.org/newsmakers. And we're continuing right after this from Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. Thank you very much for joining us. Our conversation continues now with Carol Abrahamson from the Mississippi Valley Conservancy and Kathy Van Maren from the Coulee Region Sierra Club. We're talking about Earth Day. We're talking about protecting our environment here in the Coulee Region, the Driftless area, and beyond, all the concerns that people have shared. we've talked globally, what concerns people have. We've talked a lot about climate change. On a more local level, on a more maybe immediately tangible level, what are some things that people can notice here around us, here in the Coulee region, that are signs of the environmental effects that you've been talking about? Let's start with Carol on this one.
If you visit our website for things that you can do, we have some really great ideas about things that people can do right now to celebrate Earth Day. And they include ideas that people can do on our public nature preserves. So you could become a trail steward and help take care of some of the trails. You can become a cleanup champion. So take a garbage bag with you when you go out for a walk or a hike and see if you can clean up the properties a bit. And then also, you can be a part of a birding community through eBird and submit your bird sightings.
It's true. And those are some really good ideas for people who are looking for ways to get individually involved. Let me reframe my original question a little bit. I guess I'm looking for, like, Kathy, are there things around us that we can notice here in the Coulee region that are evidence of the environmental decline that we've been kind of talking about?
Well, I am not a scientist, so I can't say for sure. I do think that we see it in the unsettled weather patterns that we've been experiencing for quite a while. Scientists say that people born after, I think it was 1980, but I'm not sure, have never really experienced weather that's not affected by climate change. So we're having later falls, earlier spring sometimes, you know, things are blooming and then we get freezing weather. And so just very unsettled weather patterns. And I believe that that is connected to just in overall the out of balance weather patterns that we're seeing around the world. Of course, we also are seeing a lot more rain here. And, you know, people like on the north side of La Crosse are now almost for the whole year having to pump out their basements because we're getting so much rain. So those are two things that just as a regular person, I can think of that we're seeing in our community.
I know the two of you must come into contact with people, but probably far more often than I do because of your work, who are skeptical either about the effects of climate change or the man-made nature of those effects. And I think one of the things that we do in journalism is to try to take people at face value and to assume that people even of differing or even conflicting opinions might be at least well-intentioned in their motivation. And so with that in mind, I mean, I don't want to call anybody, you know, something negative like a denier or a skeptic or something like that, but there are high percentages of people who haven't yet bought into the idea of man's contribution to climate change, even though science is fairly unified on the subject. How can we talk to people who might not be on board with those ideas yet, realizing that it's important to do so in a way that that engages their humanity and is not necessarily having a kind of conversation that's going to just completely turn them off to the issue?
Well, Ezra, this is Carol, and I have run into that to some extent. I will say that these days there are far more deniers, as you say, but I have run into folks who they agree that something is changing in the climate, and they agree that we need to do something about it. They don't necessarily agree that it's human-caused. And the important thing is to meet them where they're at. If we can't agree on what the cause was, but we can agree that it's happening, and we can agree that we have to do something about it, I think that's a win. And so that's the approach that I'll take when talking with folks about climate change that, you know, maybe aren't on the same page. And then the other thing is, we don't necessarily have to say climate change. I think that everybody can recognize, as Kathy was saying, that our weather has the patterns now are extreme all of the time. The devastating floods. I mean, we have here in the Driftless area, we have whole towns that have had to relocate because of the constant flooding. And so sometimes just talking about the weather is all that you really need to do to come to an agreement on the fact that there's a problem.
Kathy, we were speaking in our correspondence prior to our interview about getting some youth involved in this conversation, which is something that that I'm hopeful to do in the coming months. But I know that you have worked with youth here in the area. Talk about your efforts in that regard and what it's taken, how the next generation of climate activists are sort of picking up the message and running with it.
Well, we have worked with Fridays for Future and now Youth Climate Action Team locally and students at UW La Crosse as well on educating people about just the importance of doing something about the climate crisis and also about how a Green New Deal can take us forward with lower greenhouse gas emissions, better jobs, more sustainable communities. So those areas are things that the youth are really working on now because, as you mentioned, they're going to have to live with whatever we decide to do or not to do.
We have just a moment left in our conversation, and I want to give each of you the opportunity to talk about how you're going to acknowledge Earth Day this year, the 50th year of it. Maybe we're talking about the big celebrations being canceled or at least delayed until future times. But Kathy, starting with you, what's something personal that you might do this year to recognize Earth Day?
Well, we are definitely going to be encouraging people to tighten up their homes, look at installing solar if they can, or somehow offsetting their carbon emissions. And then personally, last fall, I bought a used electric car. So I'm hoping this year with some other people in the area who also have electric cars to start doing some Ask Me Anything about my electric car events at, store parking lots or when we can start interacting again.
Carol, you presented some good ideas about how people can connect with the earth and the environment around them earlier this segment. What's maybe one thing that you're going to do on a personal level this year to celebrate Earth Day?
Well, Ezra, I actually am a farmer along with being the executive director at the conservancy. And so I will be nurturing some new baby chicks on my farm and getting my garden in to celebrate Earth Day. But beyond that, we at our office have also talked about things we can do to mitigate our carbon emissions. And beyond the pandemic and the safer at home order, we are going to be working from our home offices at least one day a week going forward just to cut down on the carbon that we cause by driving into the office.
It's a very tangible way indeed, and brought up by circumstances that certainly we're all very aware of these days. Carol Abrahamson is the executive director of the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. Kathy Van Maren is with the Coulee Region Sierra Club. Kathy and Carol, thank you both very much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you very much.
And that's Newsmakers for this week. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwestern studios here in La Crosse. My producer is John Davis. Remember, you can find more episodes of the show, submit your ideas for future shows and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. The show airs each Friday at 10 on the Ideas Network, which is 90.3 in La Crosse. And on Saturday at 5 a.m. and 6 p.m. on WLSU 88.9. Until next time, I'm Ezra Wall. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.